It is 6 o'clock straight up. You're listening to KJNU Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM with translator K229AC in Nederland, Colorado at 93.7 MHz. Please stay tuned for Hemispheres. Good evening and welcome to Hemispheres. This is Elena with you. And this evening we have a really interesting and thought-provoking program on the rights of nature. And with us in the Boulder studio is Steve Jones. He is the president of the Boulder County Audubon Society, also the author of a number of books on ecology, including The Short Grass Prairie, The Last Prairie, and a number of others. And he has been involved in wintering raptor surveys in Boulder County. He's a consultant and he's been teaching and leading field trips for 32 years. And also you can hear him on Friday mornings, the Boulder County Nature Almanac, along with Ruth Carol Cushman. And we also have Dan Lefwich, an attorney in Boulder. He's the founder of Mind Drive Legal Services and Evolutionary Law, dedicated to bringing the rights of nature and humanity back into balance through education, legislation, community dialogue, and legal consulting. And we'll be accepting calls in probably about 25 minutes or so, so you can call in and join the conversation. So good evening.
Hi, Elena. Great to see you.
Well, why don't we talk first about the rights of nature as a theory and as a set of ideas, of practices, and then get into some practical, concrete explanations. This is something that has been around for some time but has been developed more recently. So, Dan, why don't you talk about this and maybe also how you got into it?
Sure. The rights of nature, of course, has been a principle followed by indigenous peoples around the world for millennia, really. But as humanity expanded its reach across the planet and started to exploit nature and feel like it could control nature, really, then the concept of nature having its own rights sort of took a back seat to human control. With the advance of the modern environmental movement in the early 60s, probably, it started to come back a little bit. And then Christopher Stone, a professor in California, just almost as a lark at the end of one of his law seminars, raised the issue of, well, what if a river had rights? What if nature had rights? And of course, he wasn't doing this out of the blue. It was he was familiar with those concepts, but and they started to gain a little bit of traction and public notoriety. Justice Douglas, longest serving Supreme Court justice, took up the mantle in a case involving the Sierra Club, whether it had standing to protect nature, to enforce the rights of nature. And in dissent, he said, of course the river has rights. Of course the tree and the ecosystem has rights. But it was in dissent, and it didn't gain a complete foothold. And then the EPA was founded, and we sort of took over again, and we tried to take nature back into our control in terms of preserving it. And now we know that over the last few decades, really, that approach has failed. And so as the failure of that approach has become more and more evident, groups have started to rekindle the rights of nature. From Thomas Berry, the great eco-philosopher and former priest, who really took a look at the evolution of the planet and said, every being has rights. Nature has rights. They're not the same as human rights, but they are inalienable rights on their own. And so that has led to this reemergence of the rights of nature.
Well, Steve, maybe you can talk some about some of these ideas from sort of the ecological, spiritual perspective, and then we'll get back into the legal perspective.
Yeah, well, let me take what Dan was talking about one step farther. Two very important things happened in the last 4 years. indigenous people in Ecuador were having their lands just destroyed by multinational corporations, mining corporations, and logging corporations. And they petitioned their government to give nature the traditional rights that were part of their culture and part of their spiritual tradition. And amazingly, Ecuador passed a constitutional amendment in 2008 giving nature legal rights and natural beings legal rights. And then Bolivia in 2011, in response to the same kind of depredations, passed a series of nature laws that are similar to the Ecuadorian constitutional amendments. But now it has spread to North America, and in the last couple of years, more than 100 municipalities in North America have passed rights of nature laws. Now, much of this, as most of the listeners will know, is a response to fracking, new methods of removing gas and oil that endanger local water supplies, and municipalities have been using the rights of nature to resist that. But it goes far beyond that, and in North America, it's being used to protect native species and naturally occurring ecosystems. And here in Boulder County, what we're seeing is we're losing our native ecosystems, especially on the plains, and we're seeing a new round of extirpation of native species, the first big round since the 1890s in Boulder County. So our current regulations are not enough to protect our native species. So we need something stronger. We need to be able to go to court and say, if you're going to build that airport runway 200 meters from the Northern Harrier Nest, and it's the last Northern Harrier Nest in Boulder County, tell us how you're going to protect the. We would sue on behalf of the Northern Harriers and say, show us clearly how you're going to expand that nesting habitat and protect that species. We don't have that right now, except with federal endangered species, and there are very few of those.
And so how can this – maybe we can get back to talking a little bit about some of the philosophies as expressed by some of the people that you mentioned just a little while ago, because there was a meeting about a month or so ago, a little more than that, on the rights of nature to do something locally, and I hope you'll talk about the follow-up from that and some of the efforts. But talk a little bit about some of the other philosophical underpinnings and people who have been really key to this whole effort.
Well, Thomas Berry called on the legal profession and all professions to shift from a human-centered view of the earth to an earth-centered view of law and all other disciplines. And he did so because, not just because of the devastation of the earth that he was seeing, but because of the promise that he saw that when, as he called it, the conditions for the integral functioning of the earth process are restored, those conditions, then nature has a chance to evolve and restore itself, essentially. But it needs help. It got help from humans in degrading nature and those processes, and it needs help from humans in restoring those processes. So that's a fundamental principle. It's not just about giving nature rights, and that's a be-all and end-all, that will fix the problem. What he's talking about is restoring the conditions so that the earth process, the integral earth process, where everything interacts together, is restored and is empowered. And so now we're starting to see new principles of science support what Thomas Berry was talking about. He coined the term earth jurisprudence to just describe this new form of law that would be earth-centered in a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship. And now science, through disciplines such as biophilia, E.O. Wilson, the biologist's term biophilia, that connection that we all have, humans have, with all other natural beings, and biomimicry, learning from nature, learning how nature has evolved over, you know, many, many billions of years, right? So these scientific principles are now emerging to support the legal principles that Thomas Berry and others set out.
And so what would be some legal mechanisms for translating these ideas into some actual concrete laws or jurisprudence that then could be used to protect ecosystems from threats or to actually restore ecosystems?
Well, we have an ordinance, a draft ordinance that we've prepared, and we will be presenting it to Boulder County and various municipalities in Boulder County and trying to get it passed. And if we don't get it passed through the boards, we will take it to the people. The ordinance essentially, and Dan can talk more about this, gives all naturally occurring ecosystems in Boulder County and their native species populations legal standing, which means they have a legal right to exist, which means if they're not being protected, anyone can sue on their behalf and go to court on their behalf. But it goes a little farther than just that. You know, here in Boulder County, we have a very strong comprehensive plan. It's one of the strongest ones in North America. And it has an environmental resources element that's supposed to protect our natural ecosystems and their species populations. And it was done, very well done. But what we found is it has no legal clout. We can't use it legally for against developers, for example. It's just a guiding principle. And that guiding document gets kind of submersed. It gets buried in all the rhetoric that goes on with expanding populations, more development, more recreation, all these things. So what happens is we keep chipping away at the wildlife habitat and the naturally occurring ecosystems. And since they don't have legal standing, there's nothing that can be done about that. So first we want to give them legal standing and get each city committed, not just to protecting what's here, but protecting what was here naturally. You know, in our resource plans that the city and county develops for open space, they never mention bison or black-footed ferrets, or rarely mention them. They rarely mention pronghorn. All these beings that we've extirpated that have a right to be here don't get mentioned because they're not around anymore. And so we have a lot of work to do, but that's the first step.
And I would just like to emphasize that we don't give legal rights to nature.
We recognize
we simply recognize that they exist.
Exactly.
Rights come from existence. Just as humans have rights that come from our existence, they come from the universe. They come from our source. Nature has rights, and so we're just recognizing those rights. And Thomas Berry laid out a framework. He said basically all beings have three basic rights: the right to be, the right to habitat, and the right to play its specific role in the great community of existence. So taking that backdrop as a guide, we have unpack those rights a little bit and set them out in this draft ordinance to say that natural beings, natural communities, communities of natural beings, and natural ecosystems all have rights, legal rights. And granting standing to enforce those rights is particularly important because this is where the case involving the Sierra Club, in which Justice Douglas made a fantastic, powerful statement on behalf of the rights of nature, was only in dissent because the issue was, did the Sierra Club have standing to enforce nature's rights? Does nature have rights to enforce? And so that has come a long way to now where communities are just saying, if the federal government won't take the step to recognize that nature has standing, if state governments won't, then local communities have to do this. They have to step up, state this case, recognize it, and put the responsibility on themselves, really, to protect nature's rights, enforce nature's rights, and defend nature's rights against challenges. This is how this is going to change the memes around this. All the thought processes are going to shift only by communities stepping up and taking that charge.
And just so that people don't kind of groan and say, oh, man, only in Boulder, could either or both of you talk about some of the other municipalities and areas that have taken this on, as well as the countries of Bolivia and Ecuador?
Sure. There's communities around the United States, but the largest city that has implemented and is enforcing a rights of nature ordinance is the city of Pittsburgh. And that was in response to the fracking pressure around Pittsburgh. And as part of a community bill of rights, which sets out the rights of inalienable rights that can't be granted or taken away. They're just recognized. They're inherent rights, okay, of humans and of nature. And so these communities have started to just take a stand, recognizing that there may be challenges. There may be legal challenges from industry, from corporations, because this is the other, the big sort of friction point at which these changes will occur. Corporations dominating the planet. And so it's up to communities to not only enforce protections against corporate power, but to do something positive on behalf of nature, setting out the conditions where nature can thrive again.
One of the provisions in our draft ordinance says that all of us, all beings, have the right to clean drinking water and clean groundwater supplies. As you know, when a well is fracked, several million gallons of water are contaminated permanently, and it has to be stored somewhere, and some of that eventually gets into the groundwater supply. So that's an immediate step that can be taken. It's a very, what we've drafted is very simple, and it's common sense. But right now we are helpless against these kind of threats.
And it does the ordinance also include the idea that it's not just beings such as human beings or prairie dogs or golden eagles that have the right to clean water, but the water itself has the right to be clean?
Yes.
The water
exactly.
is a living
entity. The water has the
entity.
Right to regenerate and to have adequate flow, because that's a part of its role in the great community of the existence, in the ecosystem itself. The river has a certain role to play, and it requires its own regenerative capacity, right? So all of this interrelates together, but each member of nature has a specific role, and that role is preserved, all right? And there are going to be conflicts, obviously, that you will have to deal with. And we're used to in the legal profession dealing with conflicts among rights, all right? And this is no different, really. Once you establish those rights, then you just work out the conflicts. But the way we've set it out is that all of those conflicts among natural beings, not corporations, corporations don't have the same rights as natural beings, but conflicts among natural beings, humans and other aspects of nature, must be resolved with the overall health of the ecosystem at stake, all right? That's the guiding point.
And it's not just the water. I look at our most compromised ecosystems in Boulder County are our plains riparian, our riverine ecosystems on the plains. None of our rivers have any kind of formal protection except for the Clean Water Act, which keeps them from being just drastically polluted. There's nothing natural about any of our river systems. Some of our open space agencies are working really hard to restore those systems, but we don't see it as a goal that we as a society have set up to allow these systems to exist in a natural state. Right now, they're totally unnatural. We're just about to talk about raising Gross Reservoir by 125 feet so we can bring more water over from the Colorado River to further lower the flow of the Colorado River. It doesn't even make it to the Gulf of Mexico. That's like cutting someone off at the neck. It doesn't even get to where it's going now. So that's why we need to take a more holistic approach to this than just making sure the water is drinkable and that kind of thing.
So what has been, and I should tell the listeners, you are listening to Steve Jones, president of the Boulder County Audubon Society and author, environmentalist, and consultant, and Dan Leftwich, an attorney in Boulder. And we hope to be taking calls in about maybe 5 minutes or so that you all can participate. But I wonder what some of the jurisprudence has come out of, say, Pittsburgh and some of the other places that have these ordinances. Has there been, I imagine there's been some case law?
Not yet. Interestingly, industry has not yet challenged the Pittsburgh ordinance. other communities in Pennsylvania and Washington State and around the country have also adopted rights of nature ordinances. And so they have, there hasn't been a major challenge to them yet. And that's an interesting development. One would have thought that corporations would have immediately chosen to take those on because they constitute a real threat to corporate power, right? But interestingly, in Ecuador, we now have some experience with Ecuador's constitution and how those protections and standing on behalf of any resident to bring a case on behalf of nature and to protect nature's rights. There have been several cases now decided or that are in process in Ecuador. And they're working through the legal issues. There's now a new court set up on the Galapagos to hear rights of nature disputes, similar to the Court of International Criminal Court or the Court of Human Rights. This is a court about nature's rights. And so we're working through the legal issues in an organic way, trying to realizing that not one method will fit all communities. Communities are going to take their own approaches to these issues, and that's the way nature functions. That's the way nature operates.
This is a pretty big meme shift or paradigm shift to expect a lot of people to suddenly, instead of looking at sort of nature as sort of a resource base from which we can make money, or from some people can make money and just use as inanimate objects, to seeing that in fact there are living systems and we are one part of that living system. And it's really interesting, and yet it really is something that is so needed.
It was taught to us long ago. Black Elk said, "The earth is your grandmother and your mother, and she is sacred. Every step that is taken upon her should be as a prayer." People have lived this belief system for millennia. It's just this particular industrial, post-industrial society, I think, that's lost track of that. Honoring nature as being sacred is something that's very natural for humans to do. But you're right, in the legal sense, it's going to take a lot of effort.
And I would say that this modern science and modern humanity has required that science support any change in our relationship to nature. And it's becoming absolutely clear that through quantum physics, through all different disciplines, biology, psychology, that everything is interconnected. What happens to nature happens to humans. And so, I mean, we're seeing this with the effects of climate change and biodiversity loss and species extinctions, right? And the impact on humans. And so the reverse is true as well. By elevating the rights of nature to a status that is equal to human rights, we have the capacity to start impacting nature as a whole and the climate as a whole and all of the earth systems by this interconnected process. And so, but first it takes this, what you call the meme shift. It takes people reorienting themselves to see the earth as primary and humans as secondary.
So, Dan, from the legal sense, in a hypothetical situation, someone's a landowner and they think that they have the rights to develop their land and they want to do some kind of mineral extraction because they think it's their land and they have a title to it that, according to the laws it stands, says that they're the so-called owners of that land. How would this work with a rights of nature ordinance? How would those competing rights or competing demands, how could they be worked out?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that a rights of nature ordinance does not remove the rights of property, right? Doesn't take property out of human hands. What it does is it imposes a trustee relationship on humans to act as trustees, as guardians for nature on their property, right? And so, first of all, what would happen is any citizen, any resident of Boulder County, let's just take Boulder County for an example, could bring a lawsuit to enforce the rights of nature. If the rights of nature that are set out in the ordinance, that are inherent rights, inalienable rights, are violated, and if there's substantial harm, all right? So it's not just de minimis harm. Cutting grass, right, or cutting down a shrub that does not cause substantial harm to that natural community, that native ecosystem, then that would not necessarily be covered. And what constitutes substantial harm is always a question. I mean, that's a concept that is in all areas of law, right? Juries decide that all the time, right? Was it substantial or not? And so then you would go about the process of determining, was there causation of substantial harm? And then if there was, then any damages would have to be paid to Boulder County, essentially, to restore nature, all right, to restore that native ecosystem or that natural community as best as we can, all right, using the best available means. And so it's not a money-making scheme. It's a restoration. It's nature's restoration using these principles of law that are throughout society, really. It's just a matter of getting past this hurdle of seeing nature as having inalienable rights and standing to protect those rights. We did it with slaves. We didn't used to treat slaves as people, as human beings with rights. We made that shift, right? We didn't used to do it with women. Women didn't have rights until that entire movement created a meme shift that allowed us to enforce legal protection of those rights. And so this is just another example of restoring rights of a group of beings that we need. They're essential to our health and well-being.
I think we're going to take a short music break and then come back, and hopefully we'll be able to get somebody to answer the phones and then people can join in. So we'll just take a really short break and we'll be back in just a moment.
In sun and in wind and in rain is a seed of what will be. It awakens a power that grows down below. It courses through you and through me. It courses through you and through me. And we belong to the earth. We all belong to the earth. belong to her. Yes, we belong to her. Our spirits take flight. We lay our bodies down. Our ashes may be carried away on the wind, but return to the birthing ground. Return to the birthing ground. And we belong to the
earth. This is We Belong to the Earth by Magpie, Greg Artsner, and Terry Leonino from their recording Seed on the Prairie. And we're back with Steve Jones and Dan Leftwich. And we are going to be able to take your phone calls at 303-442-4242. Steve, maybe you can talk about the project to get this actually underway, if there's been a group,
right,
if there's meetings, how people can get more information.
It was eight of us who met last spring and felt a need to do something along these lines. And at first we thought of doing this under the auspices of an existing environmental organization, but we decided it was too big for that and it had to be much more inclusive than one group. So we organized a new group called Boulder Rights of Nature. And we do have members who are environmental groups. For example, Boulder County Audubon and Boulder County Nature Association are supporting members of our group. And we held our first general meeting last month, and we're having our second meeting this month on Wednesday evening, January 30, at the George Reynolds Branch Library in South Boulder. And if you want to find information about us, our website isn't up yet. It will be soon, but right now you can go to the Boulder County Audubon website and just look for, there's a tab there for Boulder Rights of Nature, and it'll tell more about us. So what we've done so far is just begun to get the word out. We have about 80 people on our email list, and it's growing very fast. And we have drafted a potential ordinance, and we started to talk to local government officials about how we can incorporate this into local law.
I would just say that our recent talk before Boulder County Commissioners in the context of the comprehensive sustainability plan was very encouraging. They were all very genuinely interested in hearing more and having a dialogue about these issues, understanding that it's relatively new to most of them, but we're encouraged by the initial response.
And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 303-442-4242, and thanks to Guy for answering the phones. You know, it also occurs to me that there's kind of a movement of religious people from Judeo-Christian backgrounds that historically have not been very earth-friendly, and yet I've been reading some stuff about groups that are sort of looking at an ecological perspective with a spiritual perspective. And, of course, indigenous people have always had that. They never lost it the way the Judeo-Christian background did. But have you been in touch with any local groups in that regard?
Very, very informally, I have, but we haven't reached out, so to speak, to any formal religious or spiritual organizations yet. We're just starting to project our organization to the public and start unpacking some of these issues so people can understand more first about, you know, what the principles are, what our objectives are, and how this can practically work.
But we do, Dan, have members already who are from Naropa, who've worked in Naropa on spiritual learning, and who have those views and have that background and are connected to other groups. We just haven't formally merged with anyone at this time.
Well, listeners, this is your chance. I have to say, when I first heard about it, I was really, really excited because I'd actually written a paper on the book Should Trees Have Standing when I was in college, and it just seemed so obvious to me, and that was like 30 years ago. Very little, it seemed like, has been done until very recently.
I think we're all yearning for this. I think it's much deeper than just saving species and saving ecosystems. I think This is an experiment. We've tried for about 150 years, and we know it doesn't work, separating yourself from nature or trying to dominate nature. Humans have lived with nature in harmony with nature for a couple million years, and we've suddenly made this break, and there's just a sense of malaise among so many of us, and I think a lot of people know that. Mm-hmm. This is going to become very powerful. It's going to become essential.
Well, we are connected, and on some level we feel that, whether we've sort of separated ourselves via technical things or physical things to try and deny that, but we can't really deny that we're apart. Well, Steve, you're probably one of the people that knows more about most of the ecosystems in this area than just about anybody else. Can you talk about some of the things that are going on with some of Boulder County's fairly unique ecosystems? And then we,
sure.
we have Rob waiting, so we'll get to Rob in just a moment.
Sure. We're about to lose a whole ecosystem in Boulder County. That certainly hasn't happened since European Americans came here. And that ecosystem is one that most people probably don't know exists. It's a bristlecone pine forest. We have a grove of bristlecone pines growing up near the Continental Divide in western Boulder County. And partially because of the impacts of global climate change, this current pine beetle outbreak that we're going through, which is mostly affecting lodgepole and limber pines, is extending to higher elevations than has been documented before. So it's getting into the bristlecone pines up there. And it's possible within the next 10 years that we could lose all of the bristlecone pines in Boulder County. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything we can do about this. Maybe we could, you know, maybe by thinning the trees or maybe by spraying them with insecticides, we could actually protect some of them. That's a very difficult question. But what really strikes me is I haven't heard any talk about this. It's not in the news. We don't hear our county authorities talking about it. We don't hear the Forest Service talking about it. We're about to lose a whole ecosystem, and we're not even discussing it. If bristlecone pines had legal standing, I'd sue on their behalf tomorrow and say we have to protect them. The other one is our grassland ecosystems on the plains. We have protected, I think, 50,000 acres or so of grasslands in Boulder County through open space acquisition. But the parcels are so fragmented, and they're just too small, and there's too much human sprawl around them that we're just rapidly losing species. We do these hawk surveys, and Boulder County Nature Association has done wintering raptor surveys for 30 years. When we started doing those surveys in the 1980s, we saw as many ferruginous hawks, which is an open country grassland specialist that hunts prairie dogs and rabbits, as red-tailed hawks, which is a human associate species that just loves people. It adapts to people. Now we see 30 red-tailed hawks for every ferruginous hawk. And that's in 30 years we've seen that change. And we're losing mammal species such as white-tailed jackrabbits. I don't think we've had a reported sighting of them in 4 or 5 years in Boulder County on the plains, American badgers. So we're really at a point of crisis with our grassland ecosystems as well, not to mention all the invasive plants that are coming in.
We're going to go to a caller. Rob, good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have a question for your guests. 40 years ago, I believe it was this year, the Endangered Species Act was passed. And given where we are today and where we were 40 years ago, it seems pretty amazing that such a landmark legislation was passed. I was wondering if you could comment on, you know, where the Endangered Species Act, how it applies today, and what are the chances of furthering legislation at that level? Above the community level, you know, state level, and federal government level.
Okay, Rob, if you could just hold on for a minute. Our guests couldn't hear you. If you could plug that in and then turn it on. So the question was about the Endangered Species Act. And I think, Steve, you're going to have to plug in a headphone, too, in order to hear.
This doesn't have a plug on it.
Oh, jeez.
I can speak about the Endangered Species Act. Specific question?
What was the specific question again, Rob? I'm sorry.
Given how much of a landmark legislation it was 40 years ago, what's the prospect of similar legislation above the community level occurring today?
You mean on the federal or state level, is that right?
Yes. And could you please comment on the status of the Endangered Species Act today also?
Well, I think the Endangered Species Act is weaker than it's been in a long time, because there's not enough money out there to enforce it. And there are hundreds of species, candidate species, waiting to be listed, and they're not getting listed because there's not enough money available to study them properly. But the thing about the Endangered Species Act that really strikes me is, if you ask how many bird species in Boulder County are protected by the Endangered Species Act, I think the number would be one or two. Mammal species in Boulder County, we have Preble's jumping mouse, and of course we have a black-footed ferret, which hasn't been here for 100 years. So the Endangered Species Act protects only species that are about to go extinct, and it's such a small portion of the species. It doesn't protect whole ecosystems. It's a good piece of legislation, and it has saved some ecosystems, like just because we've had to bring back some species. But on the federal level, I don't see anything in the works right now. Do you, Dan, that's likely to come?
No, and in fact, I just today read about a lawsuit in California against the BLM to stop this practice of this gas rush through fracking, leasing BLM land and mineral rights in such a way that it endangers the California condor, a particular variety of fox in California, and several other endangered species. And so that's an example of where the federal government essentially pushes a different agenda in spite of its own mandate to preserve and protect species. But what it also does is it fails to recognize that a process where you only wait until a species reaches a critical endangered status, and it sometimes is hard to find out if it has reached that status before it's completely extinct, and then only then take efforts to restore it to a bare survival level. That ignores the role that species plays in the overall ecological health. And so, yes, it's a good statute, but it's not sufficient. We need to elevate the rights of ecosystems, essentially, to regenerate and preserve their own health.
We have another caller. Rob, did you feel like your question was answered?
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
And Carol, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, Ellen. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate this conversation, and I'm so happy to hear about this initiative going on here in Boulder County. And I work in Bolivia and have been following what's gone on in Ecuador and Bolivia and their efforts to protect the rights of Mother Earth. And I guess I just have two questions. One is, could you repeat the information about your organization? And I teach at CU, and I may have students who might want to get involved wondering about opportunities for volunteers. And then also maybe could you comment on, I think, current efforts going on in the United Nations to draft a universal declaration of the rights of Mother Earth?
I'll first again say that we're Boulder Rights of Nature. Our website is located at the Boulder County Audubon site.
Okay.
And you just click there. Our next meeting is January 30, Wednesday evening at 7 at the George Reynolds Branch Library. Everyone is welcome. Love to see you there. And, Carol, I'd like to hear a lot more about Bolivia and how effective that new law, that Nature's Rights Law, was only passed in 2011. What do you think? Is it kicking into the point that it's having an impact?
Not that I know of. Yet, it was mostly in response to, of course, following the lead of Ecuador, and then in the response to the collapse of the Copenhagen, the COP15, mm-hmm. I think that was, and the meeting that Evo Morales convened the next year in 2010 in Cochabamba, the Alternative Civil Society Climate Change Conference. So I actually can't speak to any specifics about the impact of the law there, but I know that it's at least reaching the stage of public discussion, and I'm not sure about the impact of the law itself.
I just we recently heard that the national legislature in Peru just declared a whole river system to have the rights equivalent to an individual. This was to stop, again, deforestation and other depredations going on there, and that was quite astonishing. I know no more about that.
And I would just say, Carol, that New Zealand also just recognized the rights of a river as a person, essentially. So,
okay.
And on the Universal Declaration, I do not know the current state-of-the-art status of that declaration, that effort. I know that it was well underway. The principles are drafted. The implementation, I'm not sure about. But I would point you to the website for the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. And okay. I'm sure you can find out the current status. And I, too, would love to engage in a dialogue about Bolivia, because I think it's sort of a canary in the coal mine, so to speak, because it's the extractive economy, the corporate dominance that really led Bolivians to the point where they had no other choice. But they've been so articulate. Their leaders have been so articulate at expressing the rights of nature, the rights of Mother Earth, that it's an astonishing development, really.
Well, it really is. And unfortunately, it gets written off, I think, by the mainstream, because Evo Morales is considered, in the mainstream press here, he's written off as sort of this radical leftist, maybe even dictator. And it's too bad, because he's really a leader in sort of a lot of civil society movements, indigenous movements around the world. I think on the ground in Bolivia, it's a lot more difficult to pull off in reality. Sort of,
of course,
the rhetoric on the international stage plays a lot better than actually on the ground. But it's a constant struggle. But as you said, in Ecuador, they're really trying to work it out in the legal realm, and I think that's going to follow in Bolivia. But if I can make it to this meeting, I would love to come chat with you. I bring a group of students with me every summer down there, and maybe there would be a way to set up some kind of a relationship, some kind of a program or some research.
That would be fantastic, and we hope you can come to the meeting. If not, just email us and get in touch with us.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would say take heart. There's, below the surface, there's connections being made that are changing these memes, and so there's encouraging signs.
Well, Carol, I hope to thank you for your call, and we hope you can come to the meeting and bring your students.
Great, and let me just mention the movie by Tom Shadyac called I Am that came out last year. It talks all about this sort of universal connection between all things relating to what you were mentioning earlier.
Carol,
so thank you very much.
We have another call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And Peter, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very, very much for doing this work. It's a long time in coming. My question is, and it's a little bit of a statement as well as a question, Bioneers says that it's all connected, it's all intelligent, it's all, what's the possibility of adding it's all conscious? Because I believe that there is a huge disconnection in the consciousness and spirit of nature, and it has allowed us to create a lot of disconnection and environmental destruction. I know that's a spiritual element of, what you said, that you haven't quite got into that yet. But I think that there is room in terms of a major paradigm shift to include the word consciousness.
That's great. And I should tell you, I do have a spiritual background. I'm an animist. I was born one. People ask me, when did you become an animist? And I realized it was as soon as I woke up and opened my eyes. And animists believe that if humans have souls, that everything else has a soul. And that's how I approach when I'm out on a hike or I'm camping. Every creature, every blade of grass, I approach it as something that has a soul and is sacred. And I think there are more and more people following that spiritual tradition. In this continent, of course, it comes from Native American spiritual belief, which teaches us a lot. But I think it's becoming more ingrained in all of us. So I think there's some hope there.
Well, and Peter, I would just second that and give you a little bit of my background. for almost 20 years was a plaintiff's class action antitrust litigator with a firm I helped found in Washington, D.C., taking on corporate power. And I went through a deep transition in 2007, 2008, and it was largely a spiritual transition. And I encountered oneness consciousness work, and that has driven me. It led me to Thomas Berry and Barbara Marx Hubbard and some other just really evolutionary thinkers. That's why I shifted my law practice. I formed Evolutionary Law to bring the rights of nature and humanity back into balance. For me, it's entirely about consciousness. And so these are principles that are difficult sometimes to talk about on a common level, but we're getting there. And by engaging in this dialogue, opening up these processes, spiritual elements for Thomas Berry were essential. We're not ignoring them. We're taking this one step at a time and allowing people to come to this from their own perspective.
In giving nature consciousness, that means that we can communicate with nature, and that can happen in a variety of ways. So I'm just wanting to say that.
That's a wonderful idea, and we should keep that in mind. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much, Peter. And we probably have room for a call or two, so if you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 303-442-4242. And Dan, I'm wondering if you could comment on this at all. There is a lawsuit that is happening on the state levels, although it's been dismissed in some states, and on the federal level, on using the public trust doctrine. And full disclosure, my godson, Shirtescat Martinez of the Earth Guardians, is the plaintiff from Colorado, but other people have been plaintiffs in other states, mostly youth, trying to sue the federal government for action on climate change based on this public trust doctrine. Do you see the public trust doctrine as something that's kind of like a stepping stone on the way to a more comprehensive rights of nature, or is it something that could be used to be built on?
Yes, I think the two concepts interact together. The public trust doctrine, for our listeners, is like any trust. There's trust assets that a trustee is responsible for taking steps to preserve those assets for future generations. And the public trust doctrine has only applied in our nation's history to, I believe it's navigable waterways. And so what has happened in recent times, in just the last few years, is there's been lawsuits to declare the atmosphere a public trust. And at the federal level, those lawsuits, that lawsuit, I believe, is sort of stalled a bit to allow Congress and the EPA to work through some regulatory issues. And so there's been no definitive answer on it yet, but it is not encouraging at the federal level. However, there have been some statewide efforts, lawsuits that you just spoke about, one in Colorado, one in California that was recently filed, an atmospheric trust litigation, and one in Texas, a small case in Texas where an Austin judge actually agreed with the plaintiffs that the atmosphere is a public trust. And the case was stayed to allow the state environmental agency to work through some issues, but it's starting to change the memes. It's starting to shift the conversation to see nature broadly, the atmosphere, water, natural beings as a public trust. We have a responsibility beyond if we're religious, and we have a stewardship responsibility. This is a legal responsibility. We're trustees.
For future generations.
Yes.
So again, if you could give the information on where people can find out more and how they can participate and how they can be a part of this developing, very much developing project.
Again, Boulder Rights of Nature. Visit the Boulder County Audubon website and just click on the tab that says Boulder Rights of Nature. Or please come to our meeting on January 30 at 7 p.m. at the George Reynolds Branch Library in South Boulder. Or you can email us pretty easily by going to our website, and we have email addresses there. We'd like to continue this conversation. What we're finding is there are so many people in Boulder with so much fantastic information about this that we weren't aware of, and experiences, whether in Bolivia or through spiritual traditions or fighting various fights going all the way back to Rocky Flats. And so we want to hear from you.
Well, thank you, Elena.
We have a few more minutes left, almost five. So, if you have a quick question, you can give us a call at 303-442-4242, and you can ask a question of Steve Jones or Dan Leftwich. What are some of the other related projects that you both are working on?
Well, I'll go ahead. Boulder County Nature Association and Boulder County Audubon have always, as long as we've existed, been working on trying to protect native species and native ecosystems in Boulder County. Right now, the Boulder County Comprehensive Plan is going through a review process, and the review process is fairly far along. And what happens with that will have a lot of influence on how well we can protect endangered species in Boulder County. So one thing we're trying to do is engage the county in making at least what's in the county plan stronger, the wording stronger. It doesn't have legal clout. You know, county governments are pretty weak in Colorado. Amazingly, the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, formerly the Colorado Division of Wildlife, has essential jurisdiction over all the wildlife in the state of Colorado, except apparently on Mapleton Hill. But they can decide what happens to wildlife. And it does include the elk on Mapleton Hill. But I think we can get around that. I think we can change that over time. It's going to take some time. But right now, we need for people to come to public hearings with the county discussing a comprehensive plan and come and speak for beings other than humans. Everything is so homocentric now. It's getting a little scary.
And how people find out about the schedule of the meetings and all that?
Well, they're published. You can go to the Boulder County Commissioner's website, or you can Google Boulder County Comprehensive Plan. And those meetings will be ongoing for the next several months.
And so even if one isn't a certified environmental consultant, one can voice their opinion?
Oh, of course. Yeah. And certainly if you want to know more about endangered species and ecosystems in Boulder County, go to the Boulder County Nature Association website. We have several publications on that subject. It isn't all, a sad story. We've had great successes, especially in the mountains of Boulder County. We've brought back a lot of species. A lot of species have been able to come back in spite of us. Bald eagles, of course, one of them, osprey, some mammals as well. Elk were actually extirpated from Boulder County in the 1910s, and they're thriving now in Boulder County. So there's some success stories out there. We just feel that we've reached a point where we need a new way of looking at things, or we're going to have more losses than successes.
Dan, I don't know if you wanted to chime in on some of your related projects.
Sure. My law practice, Mind Drive Legal Services, is working with community groups around the state and around the country, really, to find ways to combat the fracking push and the corporate dominance. I'm also on the board of legal advisors for a group called Free Speech for People, which is promoting a constitutional amendment to end the rights of corporate personhood and to restore those rights. Free speech is for people. So I'm working with groups around water issues because all of this is related. How we're going to work through these issues is going to come down to how can communities find their own ways to strengthen their rights.
And when people ask me what they can do, I say the most important thing you can do is go out alone in nature and spend time alone. But Boulder County Audubon and BCNA, we have several annual events that sort of encourage us to do that kind of thing, and I would like to invite you to come to our annual Sandhill Crane watching gathering on the old Llewellyn Bridge the last Friday in March. It's unprogrammed, but get in touch with us. We'll tell you how to do it. Our annual spring welcoming hike at Sawhill Ponds on the 23rd of March when we go out and celebrate spring. And, of course, our annual winter solstice sunrise hike which is our spiritual tradition, usually on the 21st of December, and Elena is usually there to sing Peace with Earth with all of us. So we hope you'll join us on some of those, and take care of yourself. Get out there and enjoy nature. Be with nature. Every moment you spend with nature alone helps the planet to be a better place, even if you do nothing else.
Well, thank you both so much. We've come to the end of the time, but Dan Leftwich and Steve Jones. And again, you can go to Boulder County Audubon Society, and that meeting is coming up on January 30th at the Reynolds Branch Library. Thank you both so much. This has been Hemispheres. You're listening to KGNU Boulder. It's 7 o'clock straight up. Please stay tuned for Corriente.